Given there was no coordinated and centralized guidance coming out of the federal government at that time, I sensed very strongly that we were largely on our own. As such, we created some innovative and creative new processes and procedures for the state's protection that became significant enough to receive national attention. Just a few months after 9/11, General William Crouch, U.S. Army, retired, and Admiral Harold Gaiman, U.S. Navy, retired, were in Hawaii to brief U.S. Pacific Fleet on their findings related to the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen in October of 2000. I had worked for General Crouch twice before when he had commanded the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, and I was in 1-1 Cavalry, doing the Czech border mission in the mid-1980s, and again when he commanded U.S. Army Europe, and I was one of his base commanders. I invited General Crouch to the U.S. Army Pacific Headquarters to learn what we were doing to protect Hawaii. After hearing our story, he suggested I share what we were doing with the rest of the country, because most state and local agencies were still struggling with how to prepare. In March 2002, I wrote an article entitled Hawaii's Homeland Security, now easily found on the web. I was later invited to Washington, D.C. to brief these innovative security initiatives to the new Office of Homeland Security, quickly formed by the Bush administration as a stopgap measure until the department would be fully established through Congress, 15 months after 9/11. Working with states, local, and federal agencies to protect the state of Hawaii from terrorist attack became a primary focus of mine for the next 2 years.
A postscript on the author's role on terrorism.
I offer an additional quirky story about my role in the war against terror in the early years. The U.S. military went into Afghanistan very soon after 9/11. In the first few months, we were taking in Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners with few places to put them. Two candidate locations were chosen by the Department of Defense to house prisoners of war, Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, and the island of Tinian in the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands, CNMI, just north of Guam. Tinian is one of the three populated islands in the CNMI. It has about 2,000 inhabitants. In World War II, it was used as the base from which the U.S. launched B-29s to bomb Japan. At one point, it was known as the busiest airport in the world. It is also the place from which the Enola Gay loaded the first atomic bomb and then flew to Hiroshima, where it was dropped. The second atomic bomb was also loaded on Tinian and dropped on Nagasaki. The Department of Defense leased 2/3 of the island in the 1980s for 100 years. The original idea was to build a B-52 bomber base there to support the Cold War effort in the Pacific. That plan was scrapped, and little was done with the leased land. That meant there was plenty of space to put a prison and scarce opportunity for prisoners to escape. It was a long swim to anywhere. Admiral Blair gave my boss a warning order that if the POW camp was to come our way, the Army would build and run the prison. General Smith told me that if that happened, I would likely be its first camp commandant. I was about 2 weeks away from making my first trip to Tinian to do an initial site survey when Guantanamo Bay was chosen as a location for the prison. I canceled my plans and thought, I guess I'll never see Tinian. As you read in Chapter 9, I was wrong. I've been to Tinian over a dozen times in recent years.
Chapter 17, Celebrating Milestones and Victories.
Celebrate your success. Find some humor in your failures. Sam Walton. With your personal vision and your team's hard work, your leadership hopefully results in achieving many new milestones and victories for the organization. These are often moments to be celebrated. People need such celebration milestones as it often completes a circle. I am referring to the circle of receiving an assignment or challenge, making plans, doing the work, putting out the effort, and finally achieving the desired result. When this complete circle occurs, it is vital and fitting to pause and recognize all that you have accomplished. You are back to the top of the circle, ready to receive a new assignment. As I recounted earlier in the book about my use of ritual and ceremony during transition times to connect my soldiers past and present, I also used ritual and ceremony to celebrate victories. Let me relate one of those times when I was the Deputy Commanding General of the U.S. Army Pacific. In that position, one of the collateral duties I had was overseeing the chemical demilitarization operation on Johnston Island, 800 miles southwest of Hawaii. At the end of the Cold War, the United States had thousands of chemical weapons, mines, artillery shells, etc., stockpiled at remote places across the United States. For most of the 1990s, we had been destroying these mines and shells at various locations across the United States. Johnston Island was one of those sites. The island was originally an atoll, one-tenth its current size. But engineers dredged the surrounding shallow seabed decades before and enlarged the island enough to put an airfield there. It was a logical choice to use this island as a location to destroy chemical weapons, since there was no population there. I periodically visited the island to inspect the operation and to recognize the dedicated employees charged with this hazardous duty. The facility was a self-contained structure with conveyor belts, drills, and furnaces, all controlled remotely behind sealed walls and windows. A mine or shell would be placed at the entrance of the facility and carried through on a conveyor belt. Automated machinery would then drill a hole in the shell and blast the chemical with high-temperature flames, burning it. The ensuing smoke and residue would then be filtered before escaping the building, where its toxicity was measured closely. The facility had been in operation for 9 years, and it was during my time that the last of the mines and shells were disposed of. We decided to celebrate this milestone, thereby recognizing the hard work and dedication that had been put out by the staff over the previous decade. A few dedicated souls had been there the entire duration of the mission. I flew out to Johnston Island to be present for this historic moment, as did the official in Washington, D.C., charged with all such chemical demilitarization operations across the country. The last chemical mine went through the furnace late one night in December 2000. There was no champagne to uncork, but speeches were made to recognize the service and sacrifice of employees present and past who had worked at Johnston Island for the past decade. We created a small commemorative gift that was given to each member present. Mine sits behind my desk today. People will appreciate you more as a leader if you regularly celebrate their victories.
Chapter 18, The Light at the End of the Tunnel.
Trust your landmark and run through the smoke. It's going to open up eventually. Ezekiel Elliott. Often people find themselves lost or going in the wrong direction in their lives. They become depressed, angry, and unable to figure out how to fix their immediate circumstances. It's like entering into a dark tunnel without knowing how long it is, or even doubting whether there's an exit. Leaders can play a strong role in helping people regain their footing and rediscover their way. Everyone enters one or more of these tunnels sooner or later. I've been in them many times myself. Sometimes the tunnels are long, but more often than not, you can find an exit and things turn out just fine. Sometimes, life even improves. Patience, fortitude, and perseverance often win out. Having someone help you navigate through the tunnel also helps. Young people in particular, many of whom have not faced a major crisis in their life, often struggle to see their way through these tunnels. Some decide to take the easy way out by taking their own life. Suicides are particularly tragic, as there is often light at the end of the tunnel, but the affected individual just can't see it. I have seen this too often in the military, mostly with young people who simply do not have the long-term perspective that life can improve for them. My own sister took her life on Christmas Eve, 1999, a personal loss I'll address more in the next chapter. Great leaders almost instinctively demonstrate how much they care about their people. It is part of who they are. Truly great leaders seem to know exactly when to apply this skill at the right moment and in the right way. Let me relate a story of how I learned about the critical role that leaders play when it comes to guiding others through the dark tunnels of life. Soon after I started my military career, I married my college sweetheart. I met her in the spring of 1972 when I was a junior at Purdue. After graduation in 1973, I went to Fort Hood, and she joined me in the spring of 1974, where she got her first exposure to military life. 2 years later, my marriage ended. I was 24 years old and was crushed. It was the first deep personal failure I had ever experienced, and I went into a very dark tunnel. At the time, I was the maintenance officer for a tank battalion. One of my coping mechanisms was to invest any discretionary time and energy I had into my work. I spent many nights in the motor pool, sometimes doing anything to keep my mind focused. One Friday night at about 7 p.m., when I was doing paperwork, completely alone except for the motor pool guards, I got a surprise visit. The brigade commander, Colonel Jack Woodmansey, walked in. He was a former White House fellow and a brilliant leader. He commanded roughly 4,000 soldiers, of which I was just one. From the point of view of a first lieutenant, the brigade commander was like God. Because he was so many levels above me, we had never met. Colonel Woodmansey said he'd like me to join him in a walk through the motor pool. I was sure this was the perfect storm of bad luck. My marriage was falling apart. I was coping by investing my time in my work after hours. And now the brigade commander was going to inspect the motor pool. On a Friday night, no less. For the next 20 to 30 minutes, he and I walked up and down the tank lines. Oddly, he never said a word about the status of maintenance, the appearance of the tanks, or anything remotely related to my job. Rather, he talked about challenges he had faced in life and how he got through them. He never mentioned my own situation. But when we finally got back to the front gate, he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "There's light at the end of this tunnel. You just can't see it yet." I later learned that my battalion commander had told Colonel Woodmansey about a young lieutenant who was facing difficult personal challenges and could use some encouragement. This is what brought the colonel to the motor pool that Friday evening. Since that day, my memory has faded about a number of things and experiences. But that small but thoughtful gesture by a senior leader to a young officer, buried deep in his own personal problems, is seared into my memory like it was yesterday. I can't tell you how much his short visit lifted my spirits. Somebody cared when I felt like nobody did. One often feels alone when things are going wrong. I put that rock in my backpack, and over the past 40 years, I've applied this same tactic a number of times, with similar success, on young people I have seen struggling.
Exiting the tunnel.
Making it through the tunnel sometimes seems impossible when you are in it, but I've learned that most tunnels have an exit. You generally find a solution to problems, and you should never give up hope or stop trying to find the exit. I left Fort Hood about 4 months after the buck-up talk from the colonel to attend the Armor Officer Advanced Course at Fort Knox, Kentucky. In May of 1977, 10 months after my divorce, I met Karen Lusk, who became my wife of over 41 years. Ours was a whirlwind courtship that lasted just 2 months and has persevered all these years. We have a wonderful son and daughter and the finest grandson on the planet. From today's perspective, I cannot imagine my life taking a different turn. There was a bright light at the end of my tunnel. In the summer of 1976, I couldn't see it. About 13 years after that motor pool stroll, I was a lieutenant colonel and the commander of a 1,000-man combined arms task force of armor, infantry, and field artillery at Fort Knox. One day I learned that now retired Lieutenant General, 3-star, Jack Woodmansey, was visiting Fort Knox, so I called the protocol office and asked whether he would consider coming to my battalion to discuss leadership with my officers. He agreed, and when he arrived, I introduced him by telling my officers about that Friday night in the motor pool years earlier, when I was going through a difficult period.
Leadership is caring.
I recently learned of a story from a graduate course on leadership. On test day, the instructor handed out the exam with only one question. What is the name of the janitor who cleans this room? Nobody knew, and most thought it a joke. It wasn't. Leadership is about reaching out to all of those in your sphere of influence and demonstrating that you care about them personally. The janitor had a role in ensuring the room was adequately cared for, to provide a suitable learning experience for the students. All the students had been exposed to him throughout the course, but nobody had bothered to get to know him or to thank him. But true leadership is in the details of how you care for others. Nobody passed the test that day, but they all learned a valuable lesson. Finally, I'm reminded of a Chinese proverb that helps to illustrate that good can come out of bad, that there is usually the possibility of a light at the end of every tunnel. An old man, living out on the Chinese steppes, raised horses. One day, his prize stallion ran away. A neighbor felt sorry for him and told him so. The old man replied, "How could we know it is not a good thing for me?" A few days later, the horse returned and brought with it a few mares. The neighbor congratulated the old man on his good fortune, but the old man replied, "How could we know it is not a bad thing for me?" His son decided to ride one of the horses, but the horse bucked and threw him to the ground, breaking his leg. Again, the neighbor expressed sympathy for the old man, but the old man replied, "How could we know it is not a good thing for me?" A while later, the emperor's army arrived in the area to recruit young men to fight in a war. Because of his crippling injury, the son could not go off to war and was spared from certain death. This popular Chinese proverb really has a double meaning, that good can come from bad, but also that bad can follow good. The reader can choose what meaning works best for them. But I would point out that there is sometimes a silver lining in misfortune. We just need to have the patience and resolve to find it. There is often light at the end of the tunnel. There was for me, and there can be for you and those in your charge.
Chapter 19. What rocks are in your jar?
If everything's a priority, then nothing's a priority. Frank Sonnenberg. Prior to 9/11, I had decided to retire from the Army in 2003 when I reached 30 years in uniform. I announced this decision 2 years early to give the Army plenty of warning and to allow me to start thinking about getting ready for the next chapter of my life. When I had made this decision, it had been just over a year since my sister's death. A major consideration for me was providing every opportunity to set the conditions for my daughter's launch into life. She had just turned 15, and while there were no indications my ongoing Army career would inhibit her success, I was determined to ensure that she had my full support and the dad time she needed. I learned of my sister's death when I was on vacation in Hawaii with my family and my parents to ring in the new millennium. We were at dinner with friends on Christmas Day when the phone rang and my host told me it was the Army Operations Center in the Pentagon looking for me. When I took the phone, I was told my sister had died, but the circumstances were not yet clear. We finished our dinner and I asked Karen to take the kids up to our hotel room while I dealt with how to pass this tragic news to my parents. We walked into the grounds of the Halekoa Hotel in Waikiki, and I asked my folks to take a seat at a picnic table under a large monkey pod tree. When I told them that they had just lost their only daughter, my mother fell off the bench and onto the ground. My father sat there in stunned silence, too shocked to speak. Over the next week, we learned that my sister had taken her life for reasons that became more clear only in retrospect. It was too late for us to help her see the lights at the end of her tunnel. I recently learned of a program run by a retired Marine officer named Mike McNamara called All Marine Radio. It's an internet-based radio station dedicated to supporting the culture of the Marine Corps and the concept of reducing veteran suicide through greater post-combat related mental health awareness. Its core mission is to help Marines deal with stress and trauma by better understanding the criticality and importance of sharing it with others. Their work with the 2nd Marine Division at Camp Lejeune is nothing short of life-saving. Major General Dave Furness, commanding general of 2nd Marine Division, is doing yeoman's work in bringing this difficult subject into the light with the help of Mike McNamara. There's a reason Marines have monikers such as Devil Dogs and Leathernecks. It's because they're among the toughest fighters on the planet. But as I indicated in my prologue, Marines are no different than other people. Underneath that tough outer shell, they have their own challenges in life, just like you and me. Culturally, they are less inclined to share it. Mike McNamara and his team are helping to change this. The work that All Marine Radio is doing for the 2nd Marine Division can be applied anywhere and with anyone. I wish that I had been aware of these principles before I lost my sister 19 years ago. You can learn more about them at allmarineradio.com. Shortly after I announced my intent to retire, the Army called and asked me to reconsider. I told them I would do whatever the Army Chief of Staff asked, as I had known him for over 10 years and had worked for him several times. But if they were asking for my vote, I would like to stay the course with my retirement plans. The next day, they called back and told me the Chief would honor my decision. When family priorities compete with professional aspirations, you have to decide what's most important.
Filling your glass jar.
The next story is another one of many rocks in my backpack that I borrowed from someone else and often pass on. You may have heard it. A professor is discussing with his class the issue of establishing priorities. He pulls out a large glass jar and a basket of rocks, putting the rocks in the jar until they reach the top. He then asks the class, "Is the jar full?" The class answers, "Yes." He then pulls out a bag of pebbles and pours it in the jar. The pebbles run around the rocks to the bottom of the jar. And when the pebbles reach the top, he asks the class, "Is the jar full?" A bit embarrassed, the class responds, "You fooled us. But yes, the jar is now full." He then pulls out a pitcher of water and pours it into the jar. The water finds its way through the rocks and the pebbles and eventually reaches the top rim of the jar. He asks the class, "Is the jar full?" The students have now been fooled twice and are a bit gun-shy, but they tentatively say, "We think so." The professor has nothing else to put in the jar but tells the class, "The rocks represent what is most important in life. It could be family, faith, health, their job, a bucket list, money, or climbing the corporate ladder. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that we put the most important rocks in the jar first. If you put water and pebbles in first, not all of the rocks will fit." A good leader lives this philosophy and encourages his team to do the same. It makes for a more productive and happy organization and even improves your health through less stress.
Focusing on the wrong rocks.
A friend of mine graduated from West Point. Long retired as a colonel, he still returned to reunions every year. He once told me he had been to a recent reunion and saw one of his classmates sitting over at the bar by himself. He wandered over to ask how he was doing. The classmate turned, and my friend saw that he was misty-eyed. He wasn't sure if it was from too many drinks or for some other reason. The classmate, a retired general officer, then lamented that he had worked his butt off for over 35 years, and the Army had rewarded him with promotions and challenging and demanding assignments. But along the way, his wife left him, and now his kids wouldn't talk to him. This is a classic case of an individual struggling to decide what rocks to put in the jar, one that I've seen more than a few times in the military. Throughout his career, the rocks that appear to have been most important to him were associated with career advancement. He was starting to realize that may have been a mistake.
Family first.
I have learned in my over 40 years of marriage that no matter what I seek to achieve in my career, my family's happiness remains a priority. I related earlier in the book that my first marriage failed, and I subsequently decided that I would not risk losing the woman I loved, nor neglect our children, just to advance my own career. Every decision I made about each promotion I was given, or assignment to a new location, became an open-table discussion that Karen and I would have, and we jointly made the decision together. I retired from the Army in 2003 and moved to Celebration, Florida, the town that Disney built. My daughter had 2 years at Celebration High School, then commuted from home to attend the University of Central Florida, where she graduated cum laude with a degree in event management. She turned a part-time college gig at Disney World into a full-time job after graduation and has advanced through the ranks in the succeeding years. She's happily married, owns her own home, and travels the world. I cannot imagine her life turning out better. She was the first rock I put in my jar when I retired from the Army in 2003. When my daughter was approaching graduation from college, Karen indicated a desire to move back to Hawaii. I agreed, and I started to look for opportunities there. As you've learned from a previous chapter, the Marine Corps created a senior-level position there in late 2009. I applied, was accepted, and we moved back to the islands in the summer of 2010. The past 9 years have been a wonderful experience, as my son was already living in Hawaii, got married, and they gave us a grandson. He and his wife, with my 3-year-old grandson, have since moved to Japan. In mid-2018, Karen again indicated a desire to turn the page, this time to the East Coast, to be closer to her large family, including our daughter. At this writing, we're preparing to move to Bluffton, South Carolina, for the next chapter of our life. I've learned what rocks to put in my jar, and when. You should too.
Chapter 20. Remember Your Roots.
Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. C.S. Lewis. I continually remind myself as a retired general officer and senior executive that at one time in my life, I was no different from anyone who works for me today. I have walked in their shoes, worked hard, and followed the orders and guidance of someone above me. I contributed to the effectiveness of the whole, and at times, my efforts contributed to success. The fact that I recognize that the next generation is now doing what I once did is something that I like to think keeps me humble, and the people around me more comfortable. I was reminded of this a few years ago when I was on a Navy ship at sea. In addition to my primary duties as the Deputy Commanding General of the Army in the Pacific, I held a collateral duty as a Chief of Staff for a 4-star Navy-led Joint Task Force. This involved exercises at sea on the USS Blue Ridge, the command ship for 7th Fleet, based in Yokosuka, Japan. I first worked for Admiral Tom Fargo, then Admiral Walt Doran. When I boarded the Blue Ridge in 2002, Vice Admiral Robert Rat Willard, the 7th Fleet commander, gave up his stateroom just across from Admiral Doran, my boss. Willard was a capstone classmate of mine who later became the Vice Chief of Naval Operations and then commander of U.S. Pacific Command. An F-14 pilot, he performed aerial stunts in the movie Top Gun. By Army standards, the stateroom was palatial. It included a bedroom, a conference room, and a separate head, bathroom. To me, it was the Navy equivalent of a suite in a 5-star hotel, and was close enough to the officer's mess that I could smell bread baking every morning when I awoke. Several times a week, they would have make-your-own ice cream Sunday night, open at 10 p.m. Contrasting that to much of my time in the Army, where I spent many nights in the heat or cold, either on a cot or on the front fender of my tank, I was in heaven. Before we left port, the Command Master Chief, senior enlisted advisor to the ship's captain, came by to check on me. He asked, "How are we taking care of you, sir?" I replied, "Had I known it would be like this, I might have joined the Navy decades ago." He assured me that if I had joined the Navy 30 years ago, I wouldn't have started off like this. He then offered a tour of the ship. We started at the very bottom of the ship, near the keel. There, I saw sailors chipping rust off the interior hull with a chisel and hammer. We then passed the engine room, which was extremely hot and noisy, and we wound our way up through a berthing area, where I saw the closet-like living space afforded each sailor. I gained a greater appreciation for the average sailor's life that day, and it only grew in the days to come. We pulled out of port, traversed Tokyo Bay, and headed into the western Pacific. Unbeknownst to me, there was a growing storm forming south of Guam. It would become the third strongest typhoon to hit Guam in recorded history, after one in 1900 and another in 1962. At its peak, Typhoon Pongsona had sustained winds of 144 miles per hour with gusts to 173 miles per hour. When it hit Guam on the 8th of December, 2002, it knocked out communications, damaging 715 power poles and 513 transformers. Anemometers along the northern coast failed from the winds, and the Guam Memorial Hospital had several walls collapse. Pongsona left 65% of the island's water wells inoperable and destroyed or damaged 1,300 homes. With almost 26 inches of rainfall in a short time frame, flooding occurred across the island, and the storm surge reached 20 feet at some locations. The typhoon injured 193 people, mostly from lacerations and fractures caused by flying debris and glass. One victim suffered a fatal heart attack, and medical help couldn't reach her in time to render aid. Back on the USS Blue Ridge, the captain realized we were in the path of Pongsona, so he turned the ship around and headed back to Tokyo Bay to ride it out. The next 24 hours were among the most miserable I've experienced. While we were not directly in the typhoon, we were close enough to feel its strong effects. The Navy doesn't build ships for comfort or smooth sailing. They're built for efficiency and warfighting. One of the features that differentiates them from cruise ships is that many have flat bottoms to help them navigate shallow waters. But this makes them bounce like corks in stormy weather. The Blue Ridge was doing exactly that as we headed back to Tokyo Bay. Few on the ship escaped seasickness, including one of my main staff officers, Brigadier General Chuck Jacoby, who later became a four-star general and commander of Northern Command, the command that was established after 9/11 and charged with protecting the United States homeland against attack. When I saw how miserable Chuck was feeling, I encouraged him to join me up on the deck where we could see the horizon and feel the wind in our face, much preferable to bouncing around in a stateroom down below. On reflection, I'm glad I joined the Army 30 years prior, as I'm not sure my stomach could have handled decades of churn like I experienced that day. It gave me a greater appreciation for what my Navy brethren go through when deployed. But back to the main point of this chapter. I also gained a great appreciation for the contribution of the Blue Ridge's crew in getting us where we needed to go safely and efficiently, and allowing us to conduct the training exercise using their ship as our classroom. I wanted to ensure this Army general made clear my appreciation to the sailors on the Blue Ridge. I did this with an often-used leadership technique called LBWA, or leadership by walking around. Whenever I was able to break free from the training exercise on the ship, which I did at least once a day, I roamed the decks and told sailors how much I appreciated what they were doing for us. I have used the LBWA throughout my Army career as well, especially when I became a general officer. I have always tried to show my appreciation for those in my organization. When I was a battalion commander commanding 1,000 soldiers, I told all my leaders that every one of their troopers would be welcome to join my family in my home on Christmas Day if they had no place to go. Over half the soldiers in the battalion were single, and I didn't want any of them sitting in the barracks feeling sorry for themselves. I never needed to host a soldier, as my leaders were adequately incentivized to ensure each of their soldiers were taken care of on that special day. That may have been the case all along, but my open-door invitation likely assured it. Another way to show your appreciation is through spot recognition. Since at least the mid-1980s, the military has had a custom whereby commanders, particularly at the lieutenant colonel rank and above, carry challenge coins with them when they visit the troops. These coins are typically customized to the position the senior official serves in, with his or her organizational seal or emblem emblazoned on one side and the rank of the official on the other. I've had these coins since I was a lieutenant colonel commander at Fort Knox. They're called challenge coins because once they are given to someone, the presenter tells the recipient that if they run into each other in the future, they can challenge each other on whether they have the coin in their possession. If one doesn't, he or she owes the other a drink. They are presented as on-the-spot recognition for good work. Some service members prize these coins more than medals and try to get as many as they can. Challenge coins are typically paid for with taxpayer dollars. As such, there are strict rules on who they can be given to and for what purpose. However, since I became a general officer, I have purchased my own so as not to be bound by these rules. Over the years, I've passed out thousands of coins, and I always try to target those people who work where the rubber meets the road. junior-level soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, or civilian employees. Frederick Smith, founder, chairman, and CEO of FedEx Corporation, wrote in a 2008 U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings article the following. I've also incorporated Marine Corps tenets into FedEx. If you were to drop in on one of our management training seminars, you'd recognize from your military days what's being taught. We tell our executives that the key to their success is to rely on their first-level managers, FedEx's counterparts of non-commissioned officers or sergeants, to set an example themselves and to praise in public when someone has done a good job. All these are standard operating procedures in the Marines, but they're a rarity in the industrial world. In the Navy, a ship's captain flies Bravo and Zulu signal flags when his crew has done a good job. Our FedEx managers affix a sticker with BZ pennants on it to reports from subordinates that are particularly good. Workers who excel get to wear a BZ lapel pin adorned with Bravo and Zulu flags. When an employee goes out of his way for a customer, he gets a BZ check of $150 to $200. Except for bonuses, these practices come straight out of the Marine Corps leadership manuals. When you rise to become a leader, particularly a senior level leader, never forget your roots. Always remember that it is those who follow you, who helped you get where you are, and keep you on top of the mountain. Recognize their contributions frequently, and you will be amazed at what they will give you back in return.
Chapter 21. When Multi-Level Marketing Works.
An entrepreneur with strong networks makes money even when he is asleep. Amit Kalantri. Listeners in the business world know all about multi-level marketing, MLM, a sales technique used to sell products and services in companies like Avon, Amway, Mary Kay Cosmetics, Tupperware, and Legal Shield. You may have a positive or a negative view of MLM, depending on your experience, or lack thereof, with them. Whatever your view, it may surprise you to know that the U.S. Army has used similar techniques to support an important cause. Here's the story. After running a national conference on information sharing and homeland security for 3 years, from 2004 to 2006, I remained on the board of advisors of the National Conference Services, Incorporated, and attended their advisory board meetings in Maryland twice a year. In January of 2008, I had just completed one such meeting and was walking through a blizzard to my rental car to get back to Baltimore's airport and then the warmth of Florida. My phone rang as I was scraping ice off the window, and it was Brigadier General John J.J. Johnson, a great Army leader, who had taken my job as commander of the Army's Community and Family Support Center 5 years after I left the Army. I knew J.J. because I was the retiree representative on the Army's Morale, Welfare, and Recreation Board of Directors. I saw him periodically at board meetings. He told me that the Secretary of the Army, Pete Garron, wanted to start a new program that provided opportunities for the American public to recognize the service and sacrifices of soldiers and their families, and for them to be able to demonstrate that support through both word and deed. He called it Community Covenant. Secretary Garron believed Americans were becoming numb to the sacrifices of soldiers and their families now entering the 7th year of the global war on terrorism. He was concerned that this ambivalence not turn negatively on the military in the way public opposition to the Vietnam War did. He wanted to reconnect the American people to our nation's army. J.J. asked if I would be interested in coming to D.C. for about 6 months to get this effort jump-started. I could then turn it back to Army staff. Within weeks, I had rented an apartment in Crystal City, Virginia, and was off and running. What happened next is where the MLMs come into play. I had learned from a friend in Tampa about some successful multi-level marketing, MLM, techniques with a company now called Legal Shield and decided to apply that methodology to access the American public as quickly as possible. I knew that the only way I could reach every corner of America in a short period of time was to network into like-minded organizations that could help me carry the message and implement the program. I started inside the Army with the Civilian Aides to the Secretary of the Army, the Army's Reserve Ambassadors, the U.S. Army Recruiting Command, the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC, the National Guard, and the Army Reserve. These organizations are represented in every state and territory. I then branched out to veteran organizations, the American Legion, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and Disabled American Veterans, DAV. Finally, I started reaching out to other organizations, such as the League of Cities. Like the Pied Piper, I traveled all over the country speaking to various groups. The MLM part of it was that I asked each national group to sign a covenant and then encourage their local chapters to do the same in support of our army. This pyramiding of efforts would thereby foster a broad new level of support through demonstrative words plus the provision of tangible programs and resources in support of our troops. It wasn't long before I learned that the American public clearly cared about our army, but they obviously also cared about the other services, Marines, airmen, and sailors. I recommended to Secretary Guerin that we broaden our effort to include the entire military. He agreed, and from that point forward, while I was working for the Army, I was also representing the interests of all military services. After 6 months, we had developed strong momentum. Ultimately, every governor in the country and hundreds of cities, towns, and counties had signed covenants, with many pledging what ultimately resulted in millions of dollars of support to our troops in various ways. Approaching the end of my 6-month commitment, I was asked to extend another 2 months to carry it through the Association of the United States Army, AUSA, symposium, conducted annually in October of each year in Washington, D.C. I agreed. When Secretary Guerin spoke at the symposium, he pulled me out of the audience to recognize me for the work I had done on Community Covenant. He pinned a meritorious Civilian Service Award medal on my chest, the second highest award given to civilian employees. I was humbled by this recognition, but glad that I had made a difference on behalf of our service members and their families. The next day, I was getting ready to head back to Florida when Secretary Guerin's executive officer called and asked me to come to the Pentagon so the secretary could say goodbye. When I entered his office, another small ceremony followed, with Mr. Guerin pinning the Decoration for Exceptional Civilian Service Medal on my chest. Puzzled, I asked him why we were doing this twice in 2 days, with 2 different medals. He responded, "Yesterday's medal was from the Army. This one is from me." I later learned that he had wanted to present me with the top award at the AUSA symposium, but Army policy requires that the recipient first be the holder of the lower-level medal before being eligible for the top one. He then asked if I would stay on the program longer. I told him that, with the momentum we had, I could continue as a consultant, working from my home in Florida. He agreed, and within a month or two, I had a signed contract with the Army and was off to the races for another year. My 2 years with the Community Covenant were among the most satisfying experiences I've ever had. MLM companies are not all that different than what we see going on with social media these days, where someone posts and shares a piece of news, their friends then share it to their tribe, and friends of their friends then share it further. Just like a video can go viral on YouTube, so can a good idea. If you are involved in any type of marketing or promotion for your organization from your leadership perch, the point of this story is that you should be open to any techniques that work to get people talking and responding in a positive way. When you want to create change or draw attention to a positive cause, think MLM.
Chapter 22. Having a Plan B.
Hope is not a method. General Gordon Sullivan, 32nd Chief of Staff, U.S. Army. In 2007, I was asked to speak at the All-American Bowl, an annual high school all-star football game in San Antonio, Texas, sponsored by Army Recruiting Command. This event brings together the best players in the country from East and West. They wanted me to speak to parents about their sons having a Plan B. Athletes at this level believe they are destined for greatness. They want to be the next Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes, Aaron Donald, or Ezekiel Elliott. Most of them are severely disappointed when it does not happen. In my talk to the parents, I focused on the single-digit statistics of making it to the professional level, and I knew I needed to reach those who were unbelievers. I also had to walk the tightrope of bringing such reality to their attention without discouraging their sons from climbing their own mountain. Even if the talent is there, injury could sideline them for life. This has happened many times. To this audience, I spoke about the risks of putting all the eggs in this one football basket and having no backup plan. Just about every player there was headed to a full-ride college scholarship on the merits of their athletic skills, but the majority of them would not make it to the pros, either because their talent fell just short or because of an injury sustained in college, which they couldn't yet foresee. Plan B was about having a backup plan if Plan A didn't pan out. I suggested that everyone develop a second skill set, other than football, that they could focus on when they weren't on the playing field. This might include considering ROTC and an Army career. I'm not sure I reached every parent, but several of them came up to me afterwards to thank me for sprinkling around some reality dust and helping them to give their kids the appropriate warning and preparation. A few years later, I spoke at a venue in Jacksonville, Florida, which had former pro football players participating as well. One morning, I had breakfast with a retired 8-year all-pro center from the New York Giants, who told me that when he was recruited, and before he had even given the first snap of his rookie year, the scout that recruited him said, "It's my job to find your replacement." That was a sobering moment for this fellow, particularly since he had not yet played in his first professional game. The NFL is a monopoly. With the exception of the Canadian Football League, there are few options for those who aspire to play professionally. He told me that a player gets vested for retirement only after playing just a few years. If they are not under contract the following year, they are out on the street, usually in their mid-20s. The majority of players never make it past this threshold. My point to the parents in San Antonio that day was that no matter the level of talent they currently had, their sons need a plan B in case they reach 25 years old with nowhere to go. As I indicated in Chapter 10, they should strive to reach an achievable rung on their ladder, but have another ladder nearby.
Chapter 23, Leaving a Legacy.
The true meaning of life is to plant trees under whose shade you do not expect to sit. Nelson Henderson. Every high-level executive yearns to leave an imprint on the future of his or her organization. It is only natural that one wants to create something meaningful and lasting that everyone will appreciate and look up to after your time is over. Knowing that you have contributed to your organization leaves you feeling proud of your work, your commitment, and the investment you've made in your job. And if you are able to create at least one legacy while you are still on the job, it can make you an even better leader, eager to continue making more contributions during the remainder of your years in executive positions. But more important than doing it for yourself, you should do it for the betterment of the organization. After my 22 months in the Pentagon in the late 90s, I returned to the Army, this time as the commander of the Army's Community and Family Support Center. This was the organization that oversaw the $1.6 billion business of providing morale, welfare, and recreation programs in support of soldiers and their families. My headquarters was fortunately in Alexandria, Virginia, so I didn't need to uproot my family again. The Army thought I was a natural fit for this position, since I had recently commanded a base and delivered such services at the retail level. I quickly discovered several major projects that had to get done that would improve the quality of life of our soldiers and their families. One of these was Army fitness centers, where soldiers and their families could work out in their off hours. It was clear that our fitness centers were a poster child for how the Army might have been falling short in taking care of its troops. Regrettably, we had too many gyms in the Army at that time that were large buildings with no air conditioning, a few basketball courts, medicine balls in the corner, gang latrines, and showers that were often plugged, and manned by soldiers waiting to be discharged for drugs or other misconduct. I'm exaggerating a bit, but not by much. I set about to fix this. Not to the standards of Gold's Gym, but at least to YMCA standards. A standard that American people should expect us to provide our soldiers, who have a contractual obligation to stay fit. I testified before congressional committees for more resources, because many of the fitness facilities necessary to ensure we had a fit Army were falling short. We convinced Congress that by establishing standards and quantifiably measuring those standards, we could identify resourcing shortfalls to fix it. Doing this, we were able to get increased funding, and today's fitness centers on Army installations are something to be proud of. Another initiative we spearheaded was to establish public-private ventures that use commercial developer investments, not taxpayer dollars. We launched our first venture with a car wash at Fort Carson, Colorado, in 1999. And today, we have millions of corporate dollars, rather than taxpayer dollars, invested in programs and services to support soldiers and their families. Another legacy left was the upgrade of 4 world-class Armed Forces recreation centers. Among these were several hotels near the Austrian Alps in Garmisch, Germany, a hotel at Disney World in Orlando, Florida, another on Waikiki Beach in Honolulu, Hawaii, and a hotel in Seoul, Korea. These venues serve service members, retirees, and their families when on vacation or traveling in those regions. We had 2 issues with these properties on my arrival in 1998. In Germany, nestled in the Bavarian Alps, we operated multiple pre-World War II hotels that were outdated, expensive to run, and small. We were losing over $1 million per year because of their inefficient operations and decaying infrastructure. At Disney World, we had purchased their golf resort hotel in the mid-1980s and renamed it Shades of Green. It was bursting at the seams from the demand and was among the highest occupancy hotels in the resort industry. Service members needed reservations almost a year in advance. It was simply too small. With the support of Congressman John McHugh, later Secretary of the Army, I convinced senior Army leadership to allow the return of the German hotels to Germany, and then to acquire commercial financing of $145 million to construct a new hotel in Germany and double the size of our hotel at Disney World. All this could be done without spending tax dollars, and could be repaid over a 30-year period from revenues generated from the properties. One of the important considerations that took the proposal over the finish line with General Shinseki, then Chief of Staff of the Army, was the ability to improve our force protection posture at the Germany-based properties. It had been just over 2 years since the Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia, and the vulnerability of our troops to further terrorist attack was obvious. Most of the hotels in Germany were separated from a potential attacker by little more than the width of a sidewalk. With our proposal, we had the ability to design, relocate, and build a new property that didn't sit just feet from a public road, thereby dramatically improving our protection posture. Our plan was ultimately approved, and today we have a wonderful hotel inside a military base in Garmisch, Germany, named Edelweiss. The Shades of Green Hotel in Florida has doubled its capacity and added conferencing capabilities, and the 30-year commercial loan is being paid back by the revenues generated by the wonderful facility's use, not taxpayer dollars. Ironically, because the construction of the hotel in Germany occurred after my departure to my next assignment, I've never seen it. But because I retired from the Army in 2003 and moved to Celebration, Florida, near Disney World, I was able to attend the ribbon cutting for the expansion of the Shades of Green. What is the legacy you wish to leave to the future in your organization? Are you on the way to accomplishing it? What are the challenges you face to get it implemented? Are you being selfless and wanting to see it done? Are you doing these things for the right reasons? These are all good questions to ponder about your own leadership legacy. But as I said at the end of Chapter 3, if nothing else, let your greatest legacy be that you pass on the best of breed leadership traits you've learned from others.
Chapter 24. The buck stops where?
The buck stops here. President Harry Truman. In many years of experience in the military and in civilian leadership roles, I have always abided by the philosophy that I owned decisions that I made. If something went right, I credited the team that helped us achieve that milestone. But if something went wrong, it belonged to me. I effectively adopted the well-known phrase of President Truman, who rightly said of his presidency, "The buck stops here." Leaders should admit to and address their mistakes. In most instances, if the mistake has not threatened lives or caused substantial harm, a leader who made a mistake should be given another chance to fix the problem and carry on in his leadership role. In the 1980s, the U.S. military introduced a system for evaluating training called the After Action Review, or AAR. After a major training event, a unit would reflect on what went well and what didn't go so well, and the session would often be kicked off by the leader stepping up to admit the mistakes he made. It was one of the tools that helped distance ourselves from a zero-defects environment, which many felt we were in at that point in time. It also quickly became something that separated us from many of the militaries around the world. If people are hesitant to acknowledge what went wrong, there is less chance of fixing it. And by leaders being self-critical, it makes it easier for the rest of them to follow their lead. AARs helped make us a better military and have survived and thrived for decades. They are now used in everyday operations in the military and, like the military decision-making process, MDMP, discussed in Chapter 8, they have become second nature and are often used in our personal lives as well. In some instances, however, it may be that the mistake has caused harm, jeopardized lives, lost money, or contributed to significant chaos in the organization. When this occurs, the leader should take responsibility and may need to suffer the consequences, losing his or her job. Taking a strict stand on mistakes, however, can lead to a conundrum for many people. What if the leader has always excelled in every prior decision? What if the leader is highly respected by every person he or she has ever worked with? What if there are actual mitigating reasons for the leader's mistake? What if there are deep-rooted errors in the system that the leader has not yet had time to fix? These are all considerations that should be addressed before taking irreversible action on the leader's role and future. Consider the following case and think about what you would do. The situation involves the inbound missile warning system in Hawaii that many readers may recall was inadvertently activated in early 2018. I was familiar with the state's civil defense system because I had been hired after my retirement from the Army to return to Hawaii and consult on some disaster response exercises. During these exercises, I shadowed Major General Vern Miyagi, someone I had known from my time in Hawaii as Deputy Commander of U.S. Army Pacific. He had a key position in the state civil defense. Years later, when I returned to work for the Marine Corps, I ran across Vern. He had retired from the National Guard and was now the civilian head of Hawaii's state civil defense. On January 12, 2018, I was attending a luncheon at the Hawaii Governor's Mansion. Sitting across the table from me was Vern. Making small talk, I joked, "Vern, I just want you to know how well I sleep at night, knowing you're protecting us from attack." He laughed and we went on with the lunch. 20 hours later, Hawaii mistakenly issued a statewide alert that a ballistic missile was inbound, presumably from North Korea. It took 38 minutes before we received a second message indicating the first alert was a false alarm. People across Hawaii were rattled and the state was embarrassed. It became a national story, perhaps international. The governor's opponents in the upcoming election made a big deal about this mistake, citing the personal responsibility of the governor. In the aftermath of this false alarm, Vern publicly took responsibility and lost his job. The governor was reelected. It was a sad day to see Vern lose his job over this event. Vern Miyagi was, and remains, a great public servant, and a class act for the way he stepped up and took full responsibility when he knew what would follow: the loss of his livelihood. How would you act in this situation? Would you have accepted responsibility as Vern did? Did the buck really stop at his desk? It's a tough call, no doubt, but one we should all ponder if we're to be great leaders.
Epilogue. Saving Private Ryan.
To open this book, I wrote about the legacy of my father's service in India and China during World War II,